Friday, May 31st, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And for the first time in American history, a former president of the United States won Donald J. And you know the rest of the sentence. You know I had to use the J inside Donald J. Trump there. Probably know the rest of the paragraph. It's de rigueur. It's what you got to say when you're hosting a show. And I guess everyone who hosts a show has got to say it in their own way, get their own crack at framing history. Here's Anderson Cooper doing it pretty ably for CNN.
There simply is no overstating what happened. In the entire history of this country and of the American presidency, not one president or former president has ever been tried or convicted of anything, let alone multiple felonies.
But then the same network, very next show, Caitlin Collins.
It's one of those where were you kind of moments in American history. When the verdict came down on Donald Trump today, guilty, 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 reverberating 34 times over as the former president sat stone-faced in that New York courtroom. No matter how you feel about this case or about Donald Trump the man, it's an extraordinary stain on the office of the presidency and on Donald Trump's already tarnished legacy.
I would say it does matter how you feel about Donald Trump the man. If you subscribe to notions of stains and tarnished legacies, probably matters. And I say this because people who really like the guy, and they're out there, they're a legion, who would have figured, they think one thing and most of the rest of us who's paying attention think the other. So no predictions. I'm not into any predictions before polls. And I'm also into not too many predictions after polls, the first raft of polls. Let's see. Let's wait. To quote Judge Eileen Cannon, let's take it slow. This isn't to say that it's impossible to craft a compelling lead that states important facts but doesn't drown the audience in grandiosity. Frank Bruni did it in print in the New York Times. He wrote, the first former American president to be put on trial is now the first former American president to be convicted of a felony. Those milestones should be tombstones. A normal mortal wouldn't rise from that political grave. But Donald Trump, I could see him skipping out of the cemetery all the way back to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's well constructed. And we don't know. And this whole service, when Frank Bruni says, I could see this happening, all says, but I don't know. And that's what to say. We don't know now how this is going to play out. And I will tell you, I want to take this time to tell you something else I didn't know before the trial, a misimpression I was under. Something I got wrong, at least in my head. I don't know how much it leached into Gist coverage. So the trial, we were told, was based on a novel legal theory. That's true. You could state that so as to connote and therefore wacky and crazy and should never be used. Or you could just say, all right, there are elements to this one that are unusual. But then again, we're talking about a guy running for president, paying hush money to a porn star. That set of facts doesn't come up that much. But the novel legal theory was how to take the case from a misdemeanor to a felony. Here's Tyler McDonald of Lawfare describing that.
The falsification of business records in New York are a misdemeanor, but they can be, quote, stepped up to a felony. So that underlying crime is also called the object offense. We wanted to address whether or not the prosecutors would have to prove the commission of that crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
The step-up offense, the object crime. That's the legal concept that made the misdemeanor record falsifications felonies, 34 felonies. And from everything I was hearing and reading, it would be a reach to get a jury to buy into the concept of the step-up offense, except it wasn't. Because I thought that the connection of misdemeanor to felony, felony to the object crime, would be hotly debated in the courthouse. It would be contested by the lawyers. The defense would be able to make a huge deal of how tenuous the connection was from records offense to felony. But that wasn't really part of the argument at all. When I had Taylor on the show, he explained, if you heard that interview, I was surprised. He explained, they don't debate that. They don't really get into that with witnesses. It's really just for the judge who tells the jury the instructions, and Mershan did that, and he did it pretty matter-of-factly, and the instructions weren't to the defense's likings, but from every legal expert I heard, they weren't out of bounds. So there's really nothing unusual. The jury wasn't making its decision thinking, except for there's the president of the United States over there, that it was engaged in much that was unusual legally. I'll give you an analogy. I thought the bridge from misdemeanor to felony was a rickety rope bridge spanning a deep chasm like in King Kong. You could traverse it, but it wouldn't be easy, and that's why federal prosecutors and the DA in Manhattan before Alvin Bragg, they thought it was imprudent to even try. But the way the jury approached the bridge at the trial was that Judge Merchan, via his rulings and his instructions, placed a set of VR headsets on all the jurors, and what in real life should have been perceived as rickety, or could have been perceived as rickety, would wound up looking to them as a sturdy iron truss bridge impervious to swaying or being dislodged. I'm not saying that anything was procedurally wrong. I just thought it would be a deeper river to cross. No, wait, hold on. My metaphor is above water. I thought it would be a more challenging bridge to cross, but cross it they did, without really thinking about it. And now Donald J. Trump has rendered the status of ex-president no longer free of unfeloniousness. It was an unprecedented. Yes, yes, we get it. And now it's up to Biden-Harris 24 to get to work making all that matter. On the show today, I spiel about where the misinformation I'm exposed to comes from and what I'm doing about it. But first, Manveer Singh is a professor of anthropology at UC California, Davis, who also contributes to such publications as The New Yorker. And that is where I came across an article titled, "Don't Believe What They're Telling You About Misinformation." Clever. That's very clever. Singh is interested in how people's beliefs are formed. And this misinformation, disinformation article was really good. The subtitle was, "People may fervently espouse symbolic beliefs, cognitive scientists say, but they don't treat them the same as factual beliefs. It's worth keeping track of the difference." It's very interesting. I don't want to take away from the interesting interview or give away too much. So just listen as Manveer Singh is up next. So there are a couple of pairs, dyads, if you will, in political speech and rhetoric. And sometimes it actually pays to separate them. Think about Medicare and Medicaid. Well, they're two very different programs serving different populations and costing vastly different amounts, or the Bernie Sanders framing of millionaires and billionaires. I mean, I know they're richer than us, but millionaires might buy a boat or send their kids to college paying full freight. Billionaires totally distort and affect the entire political system. Then there's misinformation and disinformation, right? Always lumped together. But a new article, or a recent article, in The New Yorker by Manveer Singh points out that these are two really different things. And in fact, his insights in this article, "Don't Believe What They're Telling You About Misinformation," great title, goes even further than that. Manveer is a trained anthropologist who teaches at UC Davis, and he joins me now. Welcome to The Gist.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, Mike.
Sure. So I don't know why I hadn't realized this. Maybe I was being mis- or disinformed, but misinformation is just an error. And the corrections box of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal every day has a litany of the misinformation that they pervade and that they thrust into the world. So question one is, have we taken this normal, human, and sustained phenomenon and spun it up into something a little more dangerous than it has always seemed to us through human history?
Well, I think there's an important distinction to be drawn, and this is not often done, between just general errors and false beliefs and the kinds of phenomena that people are talking about when they're talking about misinformation. Now, it's definitely the case that when we define misinformation, it's a broad category and it means just false information that people are holding or that people are endorsing. But the kinds of beliefs that we're often talking about when we're talking about misinformation are those that people are rallying around, that are politically relevant, that make arguably dangerous claims about the nature of the world. They have like a political twinge to them. And they are often things that people rally around. And I think once we actually start to think about the nature of the beliefs, of the narratives that we call misinformation, then we can start to appreciate some of the other social and psychological forces that are contributing to their endorsement and propagation.
Mm-hmm. Some misinformation, when it cuts one way, is widely labeled as misinformation. There's a lot of misinformation about, say, the effects of the vaccines or much about the vaccines. But there's also misinformation about perhaps the effectiveness of masks, or misinformation about the efficacy of wearing a mask when you're outside. I'm just keeping it to vaccines. But we could also talk about maybe there's misinformation about disparity of deaths by police according to race, but there's certainly misinformation about the number of unarmed black men who were killed or shot and killed by police last year. I guess if I read the conservative press, they talk about the number of black men being killed last year, something like 15, and people are wildly misinformed about that. So let's back up a bit. Is it helpful to call some of these things misinformation? Is it helpful to call all of these things misinformation? Having this category and talking about it in Congress and talking about it as a huge, maybe existential issue in ways that it wasn't, you know, 30 years ago when people believed in facts and fact checking. Have we done ourselves a service or a disservice by our focus on this category that we're now calling misinformation?
Yeah. So I just want to take a quick step back. And so I would say, you know, we are centering this conversation around the difference between misinformation and disinformation.
So far we are. Yeah. And I do want to get to the disinformation part. Yeah.
And I would say that a lot of the examples that you're presenting are examples that people think of of misinformation because they seem to be spread by disinformation.
Oh, great.
Now,
okay.
You know, there are, I think, a lot of examples of what we might more broadly call misinformation. You know, what people think about the relationship between eating carbs and whatever weight gain, mm-hmm. or people's sense of cholesterol, maybe certain dietary information that just reflect general misunderstandings. But we don't think of those as misinformation because they're not, I think, tied to the idea that they are being intentionally propagated for malicious ends. And so when we are thinking about misinformation, especially the examples that you're given, I think there is that aspect of intent behind the propagation.
But isn't the intentional propagation of misinformation, once it's intentional and the propagator knows that it's misinformation, doesn't that then become disinformation?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on kind of your model of human psychology.
What's yours? You're trained. I'm not.
Well, I mean, so I think of when a person is endorsing some factoid, to what are they necessarily consciously aware of whether it is factually true or not factually true? I'm not sure. I think like when we are making endorsements, when we're making arguments, there are a lot of psychological motivations that come into play, convincing other people, signaling our group identity, justifying our behavior. And so I think there can be many psychological forces or psychological pressures that can push a person to endorse a particular form of misinformation that are not necessarily linked to trying to actively deceive others towards ways that serve your self-interest. So I think when we think about misinformation, we tie it to disinformation, but it's not necessarily the case that the information that is most paradigmatic of the category of misinformation is always being propagated because people are trying to spread lies.
Right. So let's get to disinformation. And your great insight as to this is that, and I think this is why you were drawn to it, given your training and what I know about you, that when we hear and read about people who have fallen for, you know, wild conspiracies, the people who believe the earth is flat, and I've interviewed an author about that, or much of QAnon, we, as people who aren't adherents to that philosophy, say things like, I don't understand, or maybe I understand a little bit about human psychiatry or psychology, but man, what a radical break from reality as we know it. But you introduce some evidence that even people who believe or say they believe in flat earth theory, there are ways to test how much they really believe it and how much they believe in flat earth theory versus how much they believe that when they press reverse on the car or when they shift the car into reverse, it's going to go into reverse and not drive. Tell me about those differences and how experts get at them.
Yeah, so experts often use a heuristic distinction between, in the piece I call it factual beliefs and symbolic beliefs, but people, there are a variety of terms, intuitive beliefs and reflective beliefs, factual beliefs and credences. But the central idea is that when we're talking about beliefs, we're actually talking about quite a heterogeneous category, quite a diverse category. And two very important kind of domains in the category of belief are, first, everything that we essentially believe or model about reality to function within it. That this table exists, that this chair is hard, that when I open the fridge it will open, that stoves are hot. You know, the incredibly rich causal model I have of the world so that I can behave optimally within it. Those, I think, you know, one way of describing those are factual beliefs. Those then can then be contrasted with all of the strange beliefs that we endorse but which don't seem to shape our behavior. And so the example that I provide in the paper is, and this is just like a historically very important example, is an anthropologist was working in Ethiopia and talking to people about leopards, and they would say leopards are Christians and leopards fast on particular days of the week. But he noticed that even on those days of the week, people would look out for leopards, try to protect their livestock. And he described this as a kind of paradox where people seem to believe it. They seem to actually sincerely believe it. If you talk to them at length about it, they will endorse it and treat it like it's an actual part of reality. But it doesn't seem to shape their behavior in important ways. And now that's a bit of an exotic example, I think, for many Westerners. But
it's useful then, because it gives us some distance that we're able to get our minds around it and say, ah, okay, now I totally understand the concept. Okay, so now bring it to something that we might either think or have thought about in our own lives.
Well, so something that people in this literature, people like Hugo Mercier, Sacha Alte, talk about are the paradoxes that we see with conspiracy theorists. And an example that I found compelling and that I've really elaborated in this piece was conspiracy conferences. And so, like, I use the examples of the truthers. The truthers are saying that the U.S. government is incredibly dastardly, that it goes to extreme lengths to... So the truthers, for anyone who's not familiar, are people who endorse the idea that the U.S. government, the White House, was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, that it masterminded them and executed them to expand and centralize power and get resources. But so what's curious about the truthers is, on the one hand, they're saying the U.S. government will kill its own citizens. It will try to kill members of the Senate. It will poison many people in Manhattan. And yet they are putting their names and faces on the internet. They're having interviews with the New York Times, who at the same time they're saying are complicit. You know, by their own creed, we might say, they are setting themselves up for assassination, setting themselves up to be destroyed. And yet that doesn't seem to bother them. In fact, there was even like a line in this New York Times article from 2007 where one jokingly said to the other, maybe I won't see you tomorrow, maybe you'll get like picked up and killed at night. And they both laughed. And I think the idea that it was a joke captures kind of the interesting nature of it, where they recognize in a way that, you know, they're kind of precariously paced, but nevertheless treat it with a strange kind of nonchalance if they actually sincerely believed it. So that's one example. Tanya Lerman at Stanford has done really interesting work on evangelical Christians, where they actually struggle with the fact that their beliefs don't shape their behavior. So they really want to sincerely believe in God. And then the example she likes to talk about a lot is she visited a church and a man lost his job and he started crying because he didn't have faith that God would give him his job back. This real tension in the communities that she studied was the fact that the beliefs that they even want to be sincere aren't shaping their behavior. So anyway, just stepping back, this is something that psychologists, cognitive scientists, anthropologists have explored, but also political scientists in really interesting ways. And they've run these studies, a classic study that I talk about in the piece by Bullock and colleagues from 2015. They ask Democrats and Republicans about really politicized issues. They find on partisan issues. They have huge differences and all kinds of factual claims. And then if you put money on the table and you pay them for correct answers, those differences cut down by 80%.
Yeah. Tell me about how, I mean, I love experiments, and this is why, you know, prediction markets are really useful. When people put money on the line, it actually shows what they really believe. So rather than what they're trying to signal to the world. So tell me how one of those experiments would work and expose true beliefs.
Yeah. So these experiments also have limitations. There's some backlash that they get, and we can go into that. But so the study that I talk about in the piece is this paper from 2015, John Bullock and colleagues. I believe his name is John. And they find people who identify as Democrats or Republicans, and they ask them about questions that are continuous. So like, how many deaths were there in the Iraq War, or how much inflation was there during Reagan, or whatever? A whole set of questions. And they find really pronounced differences and the kinds of differences that are replicated across these studies. Then they say, we will pay you, I forget exactly how much, but it's a very small amount. We'll pay you for correct answers. And we'll also pay you less if you say, I don't know, over giving a false answer. And they find that these differences are cut by 80%.
Yeah.
And this has been something that people have studied a lot. There's another paper that I very quickly reference in there that came out in 2023. It was published in Nature Human Behavior, where they replicate a common finding that conservatives are more likely to endorse headlines that are false. But then once they incentivize them, that difference cuts by, I think, like 50% or 40%, a pretty dramatic difference. Now, if you'll
see... Because the point is, they might claim that that's a belief. They might actually think it's a belief, but you're saying it's not really a factual belief, or it's not as much a factual belief as it is, your phrase, a symbolic belief.
Yeah. That's the claim, that people might sincerely feel this is the case, but when they have to start making bets on it...
Yes.
Making bets on the factual credibility, then they seem to, in an interesting way, start to recognize that maybe these aren't as factual as they claimed, they start to acknowledge more uncertainty.
So I'll give you another example that occurs all the time when you ask Republicans or Democrats to assess the economy, especially in the last 10, 20 years. It's greatly affected by if a Democrat or Republican is in office. Yet the revealed preferences of their spending, of their buying houses, of their deciding, you know, whether to save or whether not to, totally not affected by their answer, or perhaps what they would say their actual belief about the economy. So that's like a real world, massive version of what these experiments are doing. Yeah.
Yes.
And so I love the distinction. I want to ask something about it. But to me, the first thing that I thought of, and I'll tell you my orientation. I know there's disinformation. I know Cozy Bear or Fancy Bear, and the IRA was pumping information, and Facebook was running ads, and there are people who are lying, and there are people, you know, Alex Jones has listeners, right, who I guess more or less will say, I think he's on to something, maybe not everything, maybe not the frogs, but Sandy Hook, or maybe not Sandy Hook, but the frogs. Okay, fine, stipulated. However, and then we societally are very upset by this, and, you know, we talk about maybe there should be some sort of government interventions. How do you handle the First Amendment with that? Well, it's only certain kinds of information. We wouldn't just want to point to all information we don't agree with. It has to be disinformation. To me, I say, everyone pump the brakes. These things that we're getting very upset about in terms of, we call it disinformation, it's not really affecting us to the degree that we think it is. These are symbolic beliefs. They're serving the listener to Alex Jones in some way, and that way is something other than really believing that, you know, the genetics of frogs are being affected by a juice box, right? I bet you a lot of Alex Jones parents are serving their kids juice boxes. So that's one, that the panic about disinformation, though we live in a connected world and it's easier to do it than when you had to print up fake newspapers in the 50s, though it's possible, far less dire than maybe the people calling, warning us about it would have us believe. So I'll stop there. What do you think of that assessment?
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. I would say something that's a bit complicated and which I think is still unresolved in the literature and honestly is a bit unresolved in the piece is that there are people who are definitely more predisposed to adopting conspiratorial beliefs. People who are marginalized, who feel, who are distrustful of the government. And there are two ways of explaining this. And I think one is maybe more in line with a skepticism towards the importance of misinformation, but the other in a way like redeems the idea of misinformation. So one explanation is that when people feel marginalized and they're distrustful, they want to rally around new creeds that create a sense of solidarity and kind of find community outside of the establishment or find a weird social place that is in contrast to the establishment. And that is one that says, yeah, the function of misinformation is really to kind of create a common religious identity, a pseudo-religious identity. And that one doesn't see misinformation necessarily as like, yes, parents think that juice boxes will poison their children. But another is that if your regular experience is that people in powerful places can get away with nefarious things without few constraints, and that no matter what you do, society is engineered against you, then I think that also just adds to the credibility, the factual credibility in a way, of these kinds of conspiratorial beliefs.
Right.
And I think the literature and the research hasn't really figured out a way to reconcile those. I would say, I mean, the larger point is that, and the point that I try to make in the piece is that thinking about this necessarily as irresponsible senders and gullible receivers, I think, distracts from some of the more structural issues that allow misinformation to spread and incentivize people to adopt it and endorse it.
Manveer Singh is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis. He's working on a book about shamanism, and he writes for The New Yorker, including this piece about symbolic beliefs and factual beliefs. Manveer, great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Thank you for having me.
And now the spiel. We are beset by misinformation and disinformation, and here's the bad news. That it's kind of true, but it's also kind of disinformation, maybe misinformation. So you heard Manveer Singh there talking about misinformation and disinformation, the differences thereof, and I've been thinking of that. Now, I think when we hear misinformation or disinformation, many of us, those of us who read The New Yorker, those of us who watch MSNBC, think or our minds go to, or our minds are made to go to, two places. One, the Russians, and two, the far right, sometimes working as the handmaiden for the Russians. And this is true to some extent. The Russians try to Sputnik us into thinking things that aren't true, and the far right also engages in that. And I'm not here to do a both sidesing. I'm just here to lay out how misinformation, not so much disinformation, I don't think I'm giving the misinformers the benefit of the doubt, but how much misinformation that comes into our lives, the watchers of MSNBC and the readers of The New Yorker, does not come from those places. Because when we see claims that originate from the far right or even the near right, many of us are primed to think, and I'll get back to primed in a second, watch out. So we're less likely to be poisoned by licking paint from the walls of buildings built pre-1950 than we are to be poisoned by, say, using regular plastics. And I don't even know if that's the source of poisoning. That just might be misinformation. I'll talk about myself now, am inundated with supposed facts or claims that I just can't quite believe are true. And I hate to retreat to a protective state of skepticism, but I know of no other way to deal with the universe or to deal with the information universe that I inhabit. First of all, there is the replication crisis, and I'm going to place a lot of blame on the social sciences. The replication crisis, if you hadn't heard of it, is the fact that all these studies came out, and then when they were tested, hey, are you sure that's true? They weren't able to replicate the findings. So it seems like, I'll use a phrase to borrow a phrase from just season one, it seems like they were bullshit. And then, just last week, I'll read from a Wall Street Journal story about the publisher Wiley. Fake studies have flooded the publishers of top scientific journals, leading to thousands of retractions and millions of dollars in lost revenue. The biggest hit has come to Wiley, which is announced that it's closing 19 journals, some of which were infected by large-scale research fraud. Wiley has retracted 11,300 papers, which, if read in a row, would basically take up all of your life and just be full of things that are wrong. They were giant paper mills. They existed for people to falsely boost their credentials by trying to say that, oh yes, we found this things to be true. Then there was the middle distant past revelation that two of the giants of behavioral science were just making it up. And I have friends in the behavioral science field, and this appalled them, because when this happens, and when luminaries like Dan Ariely, who taught or teaches at Duke, and Francesca Gino, who was his mentee at Harvard, when the good folks at Data Collada looked over their work, they found massive, massive problems. There was one paper subtitled The Effects of One Bad Apple on the Barrel, in which students who were exposed to a compatriot's cheating were more likely to end up cheating themselves. Can't be replicated, seems untrue. They did a dive into the findings of these two, and they found many, many, many problems, shaking the foundation of what could be a useful field, but not if it's so easily exploited as it was by the very charismatic Dan Ariely. There were a couple good articles in this. One was in The Atlantic, and it quoted another Atlantic contributor, James Heathers. His way of describing it was, this is some kind of mad, fraudulent unicorn. There are so many examples of inaccurate, misleading, or just really hard to believe, which is a little different from misinformation or disinformation, just not perfectly, totally accurate and truthful. And sometimes the lack of accuracy is just because we are humans and doing the best we can. And sometimes it seems by design. My friend Jesse Single was writing in his Substack about Adam Grant, who's this well-celebrated social scientist, and he was writing about calmness. He says, the best place to relax is near water. After just 2 minutes of viewing water outdoors, blood pressure and heart rates drop. It's more calming to look at a lake, pool, or stream than trees or grass. Beaches are popular for a reason. Wider bodies of water bring more tranquility. I might be able to buy the first part of that, but wider bodies bring more tranquility? This is impossible. If you're there looking at Lake Erie, you can't see the end of it. You don't even know how wide it is. Then if I put you on the shores of Lake Superior, a wider body than Lake Erie, you're going to get more tranquil? This is just silliness, and it's based on the idea of priming, which is you put someone in a mood or give someone an idea, then they're open to different experiences. And over and over and over again in the social sciences, priming has proved to be caca. That was in the Journal of Environmental Psychology. Sometimes I just like to look at the journal names. This one was from the Journal of Impotence Research. So let me, this SNP study, it's about vasectomies in the Army. But let me go back. I read a daily compendium of stats called Numlock News. I love it. The proprietor of Numlock News has been on the show, but he's on break and he gave Numlock News over to some guest authors. And, you know, a lot of them have their day jobs or have their passions. But today's was by Grace Panetta. Grace Panetta, whose name I didn't recognize, is a reporter who works for The 19th. The 19th is a website that, I guess, covered. The 19th is reference to the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And I don't disbelieve The 19th. I really don't. I've read stories there. It comes with a sheen. It comes with an interest. You kind of know what their point of view is. You know what stories they won't put in the 19th and what stories they will. There's nothing wrong with that. You have to just guide yourself as a consumer. It's just, my only point is, it's different from the normal Numlock by Walt Hickey, which I never have to play that metacognition game of, can I really trust this? When he writes something, when he quotes from a study, or when he directs me to some story about fish, like, it's a real story about fish. So the SNP story was, and it's not unreal, it's just after a little research, it gets less potent, if you will. Vasectomy rates rose after the Dobbs decision, or after Roe was no longer the law of the land. 21% increase in vasectomies. So I went and I read the study, and I looked at the charts, and it's true. It's not untrue. Vasectomies of the million or so men in the Army, they went from about 1,800 to around 2,200 during those months. So it was up 21%. But if you look at the charts from the year before the Dobbs decision even leaked, there was a similar rise in the summer months. It went from about 1,600 to around 1,900 in the year 2021. And then after the post-Dobbs rise that these researchers found, there was a decline. So a few months after, the number of military vasectomies were actually lower than the number that were occurring pre-Dobbs. So what I'm saying is, this interesting study, and I read other articles about how vasectomies increased, I think all it was saying was that there was a slight increase right after Dobbs, and it never claimed to find more, but I would say a very slight increase, a slight increase that also echoes other increases that couldn't have had anything to do with Dobbs because they happened beforehand, and a decrease where the reversion to the mean occurred. So was it even worth, if I had known all that, all the caveats going in, would I really have opened up the Journal of Impotence Research, which is a good journal, though it only comes out in soft cover for some reason. Another tidbit in the numlock today was written up as swing state voters are increasingly confident in Vice President Kamala Harris's ability to serve as president. The latest battleground state tracking poll from Morning Consult and Bloomberg News shows that 48% of registered voters in seven swing states said they would trust Harris to assume the responsibilities of the presidency if Joe Biden could no longer do so. I looked at the article, I looked at the poll, and this is what I kind of resent having to do. And it's not untrue. It is increasing more, and a significant increase, but more voters are saying that they would trust Kamala Harris to be president. It is more. But it's not more than those who say they wouldn't trust Kamala Harris to be president. Don't trust is still higher than trust. And that's not lying. The word increasingly, not a majority or most, it was increasing. And maybe it's not meant to convey a misimpression. Maybe all they want to do is really let you know that it's increasingly, although they don't have the caveat, though most still do not trust her. And the other weird thing is, as I went to the raw numbers of the poll, the favorable versus unfavorable opinions, it's still significantly unfavorable. The public opinion still has a significantly unfavorable opinion of Kamala Harris. When asked, 19% had a very favorable opinion, and 21% had a somewhat favorable opinion. That's 40%. Whereas 12% had a somewhat unfavorable opinion, and 40% had a very unfavorable opinion. That to me is as important as this increasingly comfortable with her doing the job. I wasn't lied to. The poll didn't lie. The write-up didn't lie. The write-up of the write-up didn't lie. But if I was telling my friend what you should know about this, I would say something like, well, it would have to start if my friend were saying, oh, Kamala Harris is loathed by the American public. I would say, well, less loathed than maybe in some ways you might think. And then I'd even rethink stating that. And I'd probably just say, yeah, you're right. She's more or less loathed. She's disapproved of. And then there's another category of information you can't really trust, which is no one's doing anything except looking at this interesting data and trying to come up with explanations. And then it turns out that, oh, we've been collecting the data wrong. I was just alerted to this and wanted to alert you of it because I talked about it on the show. U.S. mobility has declined. We used to be a homesteading country where we would follow opportunities. But now a researcher named Brad Foster found this out. Emerging evidence seems to be converging on a story where the, quote, decline in mobility literature based on the CPS might have been a mirage driven by survey measurement error. I'm glad to know it, but what I know now is the thing I knew then might not be true. And I look up all these facts, not because I have this show, but because I like to know things. But worse than not knowing things, I'm kind of okay with not knowing things, is knowing wrong things. Because then it's not knowing, then you're just misinformed. I especially hate thinking things are true when they're only kind of, sort of, maybe you wouldn't want to say it to a friend without embarrassing yourself true. just a waste of time. And I think it's very, very destabilizing. As destabilizing as The New Yorker and MSNBC would have us believe Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear are. My relationship to almost every finding, almost every fact, and not the priming ones and not the ones with the small sample size of 22 undergraduates, but real supposed findings, is deep suspicion. Well, you might say suspicion is good. Suspicion is good where appropriate. Suspicion is good when it kicks in because your spidey senses are tingling. But if they're a tingle all the time, that's just called paranoia. Or maybe, I don't know, the Green Goblin's behind you. But it's a pretty terrible state. And I think social science has tons to answer for. The survey results that always show what the researchers are looking for but can't be replicated. The survey results that are true but only by a small, small margin, or what they would call effect. The survey results that are true but only within some parameters, and parameters that don't always make sense, so you are suspicious about why they chose that parameters. It's not knowledge. It's not a building block of knowledge. It's maybe not just as when you read a survey or an interesting finding. I wouldn't apply a ruling that says, oh, it's just as likely to be wrong as right. But it's likely enough to be wrong that it erodes the sense of what is right. And I'm responding to this new phenomenon by engaging a lot less with supposedly interesting new findings. I've withdrawn a bit. I read longer books. I listen to different kinds of interviews. I, in fact, occupy myself with the arts. I do love an excellent nonfiction book, but I'm more compelled by the quality of the argument or even the flourishes of the arguer as I am by supposed new findings. I used to be very excited by new findings. I used to be very hopeful they could lead us to new conclusions. But now the conclusion that I've drawn is that the replication crisis, the deep rot in so many social sciences, flat out faking among famous behavioral sciences, and a general, I don't know, dishonesty, lack of rigor, talking to each other, getting around inconvenient facts, that has all very much beset the social sciences and has instilled in me something a little worse than suspicion. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the Chief Procurement Officer of Peachfish Productions. She'll bang the dents out, that one will. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, gperu, duperu, and thanks for listening.